We're talking about the wild and wooliest period of Las Vegas history, the mid-1970s, when mobsters, mafia families still had a stronghold inside Las Vegas casinos, were skimming millions of dollars a year out of those casinos, where gangsters like Tony Spilotro controlled the street rackets and instilled a lot of fear in folks who lived here, where some very interesting, colorful, and somewhat shady characters in the casino business still wielded a lot of influence within government in our town. And into that, you mix in a girl like Wendy Mazeros, then back then Wendy Hanley, married to a guy named Tom Hanley, who together with his son Gramby, basically carried out jobs for whoever could pay the price. They killed people for hire, and at least seven people that law enforcement has identified, and probably a lot more, including some names that folks in the audience would know. When we come back, we start getting into that list of victims with my guests, Wendy Mazeros and her co-author, Joe Schoenman, whose new book, Vegas Ragdoll, is out. Stay with us here on Coast to Coast AM. Wendy, tell me the story about the body in the freezer, the guy that was known as Old Joe.
Old Joe, that was in the back kitchen. Like I said, there were two kitchens. And the back kitchen, there was a freezer back there with a lock on it. Tom never opened it, and Gramby and Tom would always kid about Old Joe in the freezer. And sometimes they'd talk about, I wonder what he's doing today. And then when it get real hot, oh boy, I hope the freezer doesn't unfreeze. Boy, he's really gonna smell. I mean, things of that nature. And he never ever unlocked the freezer. And when he was arrested for the murder of Culinary Union Al Bramlett after the FBI caught him in Arizona, I came back to Las Vegas and to start packing up the house, and the freezer was opened and cleared out.
So you never got to see Old Joe for himself. Do you think they were
For the
messing with you, or
years
you
I
think?
spent in that house, he never opened the freezer. There was a big padlock on it.
When you start realizing that maybe Tom's involved in some really bad stuff, and we'll get into how you came to that conclusion, did you ever ask about it? Hey, Tom, are you a hired killer? Were
No.
you able to talk to him about that stuff?
Tom taught me from the very start, silence is a fence around wisdom. You do not ask questions. And there was no way that I was going to ask him about things like that. I would let him talk and let him tell me things, and all I was a good listener. At a point, every Sunday, it was like clockwork. We would head out of town, we'd stop and see Old Man Binion and have breakfast with Old Man Binion at the Horseshoe Club. Then we'd always stop at Harry Claiborne's house, located on Alta and Rancho. That's where he had his house then. And then we'd head out to Sandy Valley, a road off of Sandy Valley, and there was a little shooting range out there. And we would take guns with us, but Tom liked me to use the 22 with the silencer on it. And I became a pretty good shot. I mean, we were out there 2 to 3 hours every Sunday, and he would teach me how to shoot. And during all these shootings, he would talk about the people he killed and the best way to kill these people and how they would not suffer any pain. And, it was just, I didn't know, well, what am I going to do? What am I going to say? He's telling me all this stuff. The best thing for me to do, like he taught me, silence is a fence around wisdom, and just listen. Listen to him. I'm out there with this man, and he has all these guns. If I start confronting him, well, why did you do that? Is that really true? He might have turned the gun on me.
You had a reason to wonder what happened to his first wife. You found a note in his clothes. Tell me that
Yeah,
part of the story.
I found a suicide note from Mary Lou when he had me cleaning out a closet of suits, and I confronted him with the note, and he took me, he read it, and he took me and sat me down at that time there was a desk in there. It was Al Dreyer's desk. He was an attorney that lived with Tom, who died under the knife of Dr. Zellerhofer. I believe Al died. I believe Tom had that situated to kill Al because Al knew too much. But anyway, he pulled out a pad and he said, now you're going to write one. Well, at first he told me about Mary Lou when he sat me down and how he couldn't stand her drinking anymore. She was a chronic alcoholic and he tried this and that and this and that and this and that. And so he told me about how she took some pills and he handed her a bottle of booze and she drank it and she wrote the note and she died peacefully.
And then he had you write a note, a suicide note.
And that's when he said, now it's time for you to write a note. And then he took out the pad out of the drawer and he was basically telling me what to say in the note, and I was crying and hysterical, and then he would slap the gun on the desk, and so anyway, I ended up writing the note. He folded it up in his pocket, and he said, now, Winifred, you know how much I love you, and you know nothing's going to happen to you, and you know how the silence is the fence around wisdom, and I will always just keep this note for collateral, for insurance. So you know better to talk to anybody. So that's how the note started.
That's pretty scary.
So he always had that note from, about 4 or 5 months into our relationship.
So he's taking you out every week to go shooting, and he's telling you stories about people he killed. You can't ask questions. You're not quite sure whether to take it seriously. Looking back, though, you've told me and you've told Joe that you think that he was grooming you to maybe do some work for him.
Well, that's what I kind of feel, because he was talking about how Granby was so addicted to heroin, he can't depend upon him anymore. Why was he taking me out shooting? He had me shooting when I was 9 months pregnant. I mean, it was like clockwork every Sunday. And then he would say how much he could always depend upon his little Winifred. Not like Granby. Granby is not dependable anymore. You know, he would start praising me. And the better that I got, then the more stories he would tell me. And then he would explain to me that it doesn't hurt to die. You hit him once right above the ear in the soft temple. They drop, and then you put a couple of slugs in their heart, and it's over. They don't feel a thing. So he started trying to twist it, making me think that it doesn't hurt to die. So if he ever had me do anything like that I wouldn't be doing, you know, I would be putting someone out of their misery, and I wouldn't be hurting them. And he always told me the people that he killed were bad people. They didn't deserve to live. They did bad things. He had an excuse for every person that he had killed.
Joe, let's go down a list of some of those names. Some of them who
still there because he.
Joe's
every
back.
Every time I hear the story, I'm equally astounded.
Yeah. There were some names that were killed. Bad things happened to these people, whether they're bad people or not. We don't know, you know, we'll leave that to history to judge. But before Wendy was on the scene, but you've been able to piece together a lot of their background and the background on their demise. James Hartley, who was he?
James Hartley, a bigwig union guy. He was a friend of Tom's as well. Just as Ralph Alsup was another union man who was, I think Tom at one point said he was like a best friend to him, was another man that Wendy said said Tom had told her he killed him, and then he took her out to the place and showed her where he had hidden and where he had pulled the trigger to kill Alsop.
And he said the reason that he killed Ralph Alsop was because he was just diagnosed with cancer a couple of weeks earlier, right. So it was best just to put him out of his misery.
It's my understanding, as I remember it, didn't they, Tom Hanley and Ralph Alsop kill James Hartley together, and then
later
Tom killed Ralph?
That's the story. I mean, that's the story, as it's sort of winding its way out.
And then they took Jim Hartley's car, drove it down into L.A. in front of Blackie's union to give Blackie a warning.
I mean, the list is sort of endless. Jay Vandermark, a case which has never been...
Well, Vandermark was running from...
the mob.
Joey O'Brien, Joey Iupa. I called him Joey O'Brien. He told me that was easier to call him that because I could never pronounce his name. And so Vandermark ran to Tom for protection because he thought Tony Spilotra was going to kill him for stealing all the money out of the Stardust scam. And Tom called Joey O'Brien. He returned his call, and Tom was trying on the phone to convince Joey that Vandermark didn't steal the money, because he had only one suitcase with him, and it looked like a Samsonite, big black Samsonite suitcase, a nice black Samsonite suitcase. And he was trying to explain to Joey that Tony stole the money and put it into his new Gold Rush jewelry store, and Vandermark did not steal the money.
All right, we're throwing a lot of names at the audience that does not know, so maybe we take this in order here and just kind of follow a pattern. There was a guy named Marvin Shoemate who was a cab driver in 1967. Joe, do you remember that part of the story, what he did that got him killed?
Yeah, he had planned to kidnap one of Binion's children. The plan never got to fruition, but his cohort in the scheme, you know, fessed up to Binion, and Shoemate paid the price.
There was a guy named Alphonse Bass. Wendy, do you know how he fits into this story and what became of him?
Yes.
I seem to recall that was a really terrible killing.
Yes, he was actually Tom's bodyguard, and he worked with Tom. And so anyway, they wanted him for questioning for the Shoemate murder. And he did give a statement. Then he recanted his statement. And Tom was in prison when he was killed. And then he was taken down. There was a house who Tom's sister owned next to the office trailer. And Bass was taken down into the basement and tied to a chair by Granby and Jane, Tom's sister, and they gave him Tylenol and downers, and then they lit him on fire.
Yeah, he was burned. But Tom was in so Granby, you think, did that one?
Granby did that one, and then Tom told me he really didn't need to die. it was like he was blaming it on Granby and Jane for doing it. And then after that, Jane and Al Dreyer, Tom's attorney, were brought up on murder charges for his murder. And every attorney in Las Vegas showed up at Al's hearing in front of the judge, and they said there's no way this man could murder anyone. And eventually the charges were dropped, and Jane never was able to collect the insurance on the house that burnt halfway.
There was an FBI agent, a former FBI agent, who got into business and I guess was part landlord on a piece of Binion's Horseshoe. This is 1972. His name is William Coulthard, and something really bad happened to him. Joe, can you pick up that part of the story?
Yeah, I guess he, you know, and some of this has been written about in other books and places. He had been, he wanted Binion to either pay more on the lease or get out of the Horseshoe, and Benny Binion was very unhappy about it after, from what I'd read, trying to work out to resolve the issue. And Tom, you know, the case has never been solved, but allegedly blew him up in his car in a parking garage downtown Las Vegas.
That was a serious, major, major crime, shook the town literally and figuratively. And Wendy, as you know, it's something that the FBI is still interested in, because after you sort of surfaced and started publicly making statements about what you knew, they came and talked to you about it, didn't they?
Yes. In fact, you and I went down to the homicide division. We were supposed to meet with Detective Hatch. And there was only supposed to be one detective there. And when we went into the homicide division, they put me in a little room with about seven detectives from the FBI, the Justice Department, the Internal Affairs, homicide. And they had a list of all these names going down the name. And you were sitting outside of this room, and I froze up. I froze up because we were only supposed to be talking to Dave Hatch. And when we got down there, there were all these cops in this room, and I froze up, and I got scared, and I really didn't say much. I just kept asking, where's George Knapp? He brought me down here.
Well, I mean, you know, it would be a scary situation. There you are being grilled by feds about the murder of an FBI agent. That's pretty spooky stuff. But, I mean, just the fact that that many people would come out to talk to you, and, Joe, you can give your opinion about this, but it seemed like they took Wendy as to be a credible witness.
No, very much so. I mean, it's incredible to think of her at the center, and Tom and Granby at the center of just so many numerous well-known murders. But, you know, it's in dispute. I guess people could dispute it, but these people were murdered. I mean, I can't think of her name at the top of my head. You'll know it. The woman from San Diego, the investigator.
Tamara Rand.
All these people, who allegedly Tom and or Granby had a hand in killing. These are cases that have never been solved. You know, I think there's a perception that people kind of generally know these guys might have been involved in it, but they've never been formally put to rest. And there's more than grains of truth to all this stuff. And we haven't even mentioned the two, you know, the biggest names.
Yeah. We're coming to that.
But I did work with the police, the detectives on the Tamara Rand case, and he was able to place Granby in California, Tom's son, Granby Hanley, in California the day after Tamara Rand was murdered. And the reason he was able to place Granby in California was because Granby was arrested for running through a orchard, a grape orchard field, and he had just vandalized and tried to burn up Cesar Chavez's union.
We'll come back to that story. That's a pretty interesting story. Tamara Rand and maybe Don Bowles as well. And then the big one, Al Bramlett. That's the one that got Granby and Tom thrown into prison. Stay with us, everyone. Coast to Coast AM. 1977. That's the time frame we're discussing on the tonight's program. Our interview with Wendy Mazeros and Joe Schoenman, co-authors of the new book Vegas Ragdoll. Just before the break, Wendy mentioned the name of Tamara Rand. She was a San Diego businesswoman who had done business with a guy named Alan Glick, who was the mob's frontman in what was known as the Argent casinos back in that day. Millions and millions of dollars were being skimmed from those casinos. Tamara Rand represented a threat. She was threatening to take a piece of the action, take Alan Glick to court, and force a whole lot of scrutiny that no one wanted at that time. And suddenly she came up dead, murdered in her home in San Diego. In the movie version, they ascribed that crime to Tony Spilotro. Wendy Mazeros believes that Granby Hanley is the one that carried it out. And as she just mentioned, Granby was in California in that time frame. I know that police later questioned Wendy about it, what she might know about it years later, and that case officially is still unsolved, but the Hanleys were certainly at the top of the list. Another case we're going to explore is the murder of a journalist named Don Bowles from the Arizona Republic, and whether or not these guys had anything to do with that, and the big case that got him put into prison, the murder of Al Bramlett, a labor leader here in Nevada. We'll get into that and more right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Here's a name that every investigative reporter in the country would recognize, Don Bowles. He was a reporter for the Arizona Republic. He was chasing some very bad people that had connections to Las Vegas, gambling interests and things of the sort, writing a lot of very hard-hitting stories. And then he died in a firebombing, a car bombing, not too dissimilar to the firebomb and car bomb that killed the ex-FBI agent William Coulthard. Wendy, did you ever hear Tom or Granby talk about Don Bowles?
Tom always talked about him, and he would always refer to him if he didn't like what a reporter would say about him or write about him, he would say he's going to end up just like Dan Bowles. They better watch out.
Joe, do you have any kind of other additional supporting material to suggest they were involved in that, or was it the kind of thing they would say to Tom might say to a reporter to scare him?
Well, I think that was my sense that maybe he would say that. I think he would say it to Wendy as well to also reinforce, you know, his strength and his power and to instill some fear in her. But as for corroborations. No, nothing other than the fact that Bowles, you know, in his investigation of Emprise, touched on some powerful figures and casinos in Las Vegas when he was investigating Emprise. Emprise's connections to organized crime around that time in 1972, Emprise and six other people were convicted of concealing their ownership in the Frontier Hotel and Casino in Vegas. I mean, you know, I guess you can extrapolate and from that point on, but there's nothing concrete. But there is that connection.
Let's talk about the crime that put Tom and Granby away. Al Bramlett. Joe, we'll start with you to describe who Al Bramlett was, what kind of stature he had in Nevada, in Las Vegas at that time. And then Wendy will go to you and say how you got to meet him. Joe, starting with you.
Yeah, Bramlett was the king of the unions. He started small in the 40s organizing the culinary, and by the 70s it had become the largest union in the area. He was sort of he was feted when he went into casinos. He had what a lot of culinary members thought was too cozy of a relationship with casino operators, but, you know, he kept everything running smoothly. The trains came in on time. Workers did their jobs. They were getting paid fairly well, enough to buy, as the old myth of Las Vegas. It's a myth now anyways, where you could make enough as a waitress to buy a house and put your kids through school. He was one of the biggest men in town, he and Binion, and because he kept everything going smoothly with thousands and thousands of workers who did the jobs for the casinos.
When you look at his lifestyle, how he lived, the things that he owned, though, it's clear that he was living above his means. He was living on something other than a modest union salary.
Right. I mean, the descriptions of some of that I read in some old newspaper articles about his clothing and jewelry that he wore, And then from Wendy, you know, about his drug habits. And, yeah, and I think, I don't know if every guy in Vegas drove a Cadillac at the time or some huge car like that, but, you know, he had one of those. And I saw him in interviews, and he had air about him of untouchability. I mean, no question seemed to faze him. He seemed to have an answer for everything.
He was arrogant.
Very, I guess you could say, yeah, he came off sort of that way. He sort of, it reminded me of, he was just challenging people to find, you know, find what I did wrong. Thinking.
Well, he was maybe the most powerful labor leader Nevada's ever had, certainly of his time. Wendy, what was the relationship between Al Bramlett and Tom Hanley?
To me, they seemed like very close friends. I was there almost every day. Because Tom was fixing some air conditioning for Al. So I was there almost every day and around the two of them. And Tom did, Tom was his muscle man too, you know, just like Tom was the enforcer for the Teamsters Union. Tom was the enforcer for the Culinary Union. Tom bombed restaurants for Al. If the restaurants would not go union and Al didn't like it, then Tom and Granby were out bombing restaurants here in Las Vegas.
I should just tell listeners that is not hyperbole. During the mid-1970s, a number of restaurants wanted to go non-union. They wanted to divest themselves of the culinary, and all of a sudden those restaurants started blowing up.
Right. It was, let's see, Louis Wiener's restaurant, the Alpine Village. What were a couple of the other restaurants, Joe?
Starboard Tack. Well,
Wendy, let me ask you this. Did you ever see any proof that Tom and Granby were involved in making or planting those bombs? Did they talk about it? Did you see any bomb-making equipment?
They were making the bombs in the backyard. But I really, you know, like I said, you don't say anything. You know, they were making the bombs in the backyard. And I remember one time Tom took me over to this gentleman's house off of Rancho and off of Rancho Avenue. Out there where there's some ranch area. And I know his name because I'm not going to mention it now because I think he's the one that supplied the dynamite for William Coulthart's murder. But he handed Tom a box of dynamite when all these bombings were going on. And, you know, he was in Vegas a long time, and I think that's where they were getting the dynamite.
So there were all these restaurants that tried to go non-union. A couple of them were blown up. You think that Tom and Granby, the ones were responsible doing that as at the behest of Al Bramlett, right?
Exactly. In fact, Al Bramlett even wanted the merry-go-round blown up at the Circus Circus, and that upset Tom. That upset Tom that he wanted the merry-go-round blowing up. Because the Circus Circus wasn't cooperating with him either. Like I said, Al Bramlett was very arrogant, and he had a taste of that power. He thought he owned Vegas, and he thought he could run Vegas. He embezzled millions of dollars from the Culinary Workers Union Fund. He was shipping it over to Switzerland, and he just got too arrogant for his britches.
Well, in the end, he was kidnapped by Tom and Granby and another man, taken out into the desert, and shot. And for a while there, everybody in the state was looking for Al Bramlett. Later, I'm just jumping ahead a little bit for the sake of our listeners, but the assumption always was that Tom and Granby did this because Al Bramlett owed them money, that he owed them money for the firebombings, but you always knew that it was something else.
It was something else. It was... Ed Hanley wanted control over the pension fund.
Okay, Ed Hanley is the head of the International Culinary Union.
Exactly, and Ed Hanley was already involved with the mob at the time, so it all came together. And Ed Henley wanted the, and Ben Smoody was even in on it a little bit, helping. But he, and Al said he wasn't going to give his pension fund up. He wasn't going to do it, and that's why he was killed.
So Ed Henley, no relation to Tom and Granby, wanted to take over the Culinary Union in Las Vegas, one of the biggest locals in the country, because he wanted access to their health and welfare pension fund.
Along with the LCN.
We should point out that Ed Henley, in numerous federal law enforcement reports, had been identified as an associate of organized crime, that he had been handpicked for his job as head of the International Union by, I think, Joey Ayupa.
Right.
Who was that? One of the Chicago mob leaders,
and Tom is the one that answered to him.
Joe, anything to add to this little scene before we get on to the arrest of Tom and Granby for this crime?
It's just all, you know, you really have to read the book. Wendy goes into quite a bit of detail of her fear of the fact of being knocked off herself as Tom's going back to retracing some of his steps, and it's in the dark of night, and it's just, you know, there's so much to it. It's pretty remarkable. It's a pretty horrific story, and again, it's something she kept to herself for so many years out of, she just learned to keep quiet, and that's what she did.
Eventually.
And I'd like to point out, when they were arrested, Tom and Granby, when the DA was going after the death penalty, they eventually made a deal with the FBI, and they wanted to put me in the witness protection plan with me and Tom's daughter, and I refused that. I thought I would be better out on my own. But in the meantime, Tom and Granby made a deal with the FBI that if they dropped the death penalty, that they would travel. You know, they were taking them around to Kansas, Milwaukee, Chicago. You know, all these places to testify in grand juries to start the indictments. The Dorfman case got started to start these indictments against the union leaders and the mobsters. And what Tom was doing was connecting the mob connections with the union leaders.
So they had promised to make that. They promised to make that deal. Did they?
Yes. Well, Tom started messing up because he started not getting what he wanted. And so he eventually died, and then but they were able to start the title Section 3. They had enough information from Tom and Granby to start wiretapping a lot of these people through the grand juries, what Tom and Granby's testimony, and that's how a lot of these cases started, even before Straw Man 1 or Straw Man 2. And so that it was Tom and Granby that started the testifying and connecting the mobsters with the union officials. And after Tom died, Granby would not say a word. He froze up. Then they brought him in front of the Senate, the U.S. Senate, to testify. They wanted to ask him questions about certain union leaders, about Tony Spilotro, and Bugsy Siegel was at the bottom of the list. And so Granby got in front of the U.S. Senate, and they had him behind these big screens, and it was all over the TV, and they made a big hoopla about it, and Granby sat there and stood on the fifth, and he even pissed off the FBI even more. But he was allowed to make one call after that, and he said they had him in quarantine. They wouldn't let him talk to the media, and he wanted to talk to the media, and he wasn't going to say anything more until he was able to talk to the media. Well, they didn't let him talk to the media, and so he stood on the fifth on all the questions on the U.S. Senate, and then they never got anything from him, and they locked him away under the federal witness program, hid someplace in a prison in Arizona. It was the last place that the detective that I was working with on the Tamaran case found him. So I don't even know if he's still alive.
Let's back up for a second. So Tom and Granby grab Al Bramlett, the labor leader. They take him out in the desert. They kill him. They stuck his arm up out of the dirt, right? That's the story you had told me and Joe.
That's what Granby had told me when I was in Arizona at where they were hiding out at, what was his name? The guy that made the silencers. He had a small estate in Arizona. It was a cute little estate. And Granby just out of the blurb, I was walking upstairs. He was walking downstairs, and he said something about sticking Al's hand out of the grave and saying goodbye to the world. And I kind of like just walked past him through the stairs and kind of giggled because I was around killers and I wasn't going to say, why did you do that? What did you do? And blah, 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 because I would have been dead. I think they were all testing me.
Back to this part of the story, you know, so they kill Al Bramlett, they stuff him out there in the desert, everybody is looking for him for a while, eventually they found him, but in the meantime, Tom and Granby are on the run, and you say that they had help along the way, because they hid out for all over the place for a while.
Yeah, I was going into the horseshoe picking up 10,000 here, 10,000 there. We were in San Jose, they picked up money in San Jose. They were all over, and they were on the run for about 2.5-3 months. And in the meantime, people were taking me. Tom's niece was taking me to go meet Tom, or an attorney was, and I would stay with Tom for a while, and then he would let me come back to Vegas. But yeah, they were on the run. The FBI was looking for them.
Well, it's amazing that the cops or FBI weren't following you to go see where he was.
Well, they did follow me to, Teddy sent me to Kansas City to an old mobster friend there. And the homicide detectives did have a tag on me just to get away to rest and get out of everything. And Teddy put me on a plane and sent me to Kansas City, and I was there for a week. But they knew everything that I did, even what I did when I got back to Vegas. And, I mean, they had followed me all the way to Kansas City and back to Vegas.
And I guess this is the time when Wendy becomes a one-name phenomena, a household name in Las Vegas, where all you needed in a headline was Wendy, who Wendy was. Right, Joe?
Yeah, she, you know, eventually after Tom and Granby were arrested, she was arrested as well, and indicted on murder charges, which eventually...
I wasn't indicted. I was arrested.
Arrested on murder charges.
First for first-degree murder, and then it was dropped to conspiracy, and I was in jail for 2 weeks, and then Benny Binion bailed me out of jail, and so that's what happened.
But everybody knew the name. Everybody knew who Wendy was. Everybody
yeah, and then
was.
By then, it was Wendy does this. When Wendy ran from from the news media down in that alley.
There's like Elvis and Cher and Wendy.
Back then I was so young, and then I was with this old man, and it appealed to people, you know, back in those days. You know, what is this young girl doing with this old man?
Well, it's a heck of a story, and we continue delving into Vegas Ragdoll, a new book by Wendy Mazeros and Joe Schoenman, after this. And we're opening up the phone lines here, so get your questions ready on Coast to Coast AM.